In an ever-changing world, with ever-changing lives, Life Changes Network presents a voice of truth and inspiration. This is Life Changes with Filippo, with unforgettable, ever-insightful conversations that captivate our fascination and insatiability for the inspiring moments of real-life journeys. As we, as one, strive for higher planes of existence and a better understanding of ourselves and the world in which we live, always remembering, life changes. This is radio like you'd never felt before. This is Life Changes with Filippo, and tonight's special guest is Lamont Wood, author of Out of Place in Time and Space. And now your host, our MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
Ciao, everyone, and thank you, Mark, for that introduction. I don't know if anybody has noticed, but talk about life changes. Introduction changes is what we should be saying, because this introduction seems to have been changing every single week, and I like this one. I know next week's will be different, and I actually kind of like the idea of the introduction changing every week. It's really fun. And what's also really fun is the conversation we're going to be having today with Lamont Wood. It's more than fun. It's fascinating. It's crazy, actually. I'll explain as we get into it. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about while starting to go through this book, and then I no longer thought about it, but because I wasn't sure where to place it. And I'm hoping that Lamont can help me with this too. I was thinking about some of the experiences that were talked about in the book, and how sometimes we either get premonitions about things coming up. You know, like you think of something and then you don't think anything of it, and later on it happens, and you think, "Wow, I was thinking that," or you think of something and you do think of. You do think, hey, I wonder if this is going to happen, and then it does happen sometimes, or a lot of times maybe. And I also, you know, people say if you write something down, then it happens easier because your subconscious mind starts to work on it. Other people say that, you know, that what's going to happen is already in the consciousness of the people, or written kind of in the software, so to speak, of the world, or in the matrix. So I was thinking of all these things and totally confusing myself, because it isn't something that we deal in every day. And I was thinking, well, maybe we should, and maybe this is different. But I was thinking of my niece, who's only like 6 or 7, who doesn't say, and who's never said, that she wants to be a ballerina. She's always said from day one that she is a ballerina. And so the way she walks, the way she talks, the things she talks about, and she literally says, us ballerinas don't do that. Or, you know, us ballerinas like this, or like to dress like this. It never, ever in her parlance does she say wanna be, will be, hope to be, should be, dream to be. No, she already is. And I just wonder if that's kind of like putting it in the law, or if that's something that she's already born with, so it's already built in her matrix that's what she is. I wonder if maybe our parlance of when we say, oh, someday I want to be an actor, if that actually creates a chasm in what is actual reality to what we've now screwed up by saying we hope someday to be, or we want to be, and that if that is our desire, then that means it's part of us already. Because you look at it, you know, usually people don't, like they say, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. People don't usually say that they want to be things that are too far from their current possibilities. So in other words, they're aligned, at least in thought, but, Do you see how this is like this slippery slope? I mean,
yeah, I do.
Lamont, hold on, because I'm gonna hope you answer to this in just a moment, because it has been confusing in my mind. And what Lamont does in his book is tell us about things that either, well, this is the other side of it. Like maybe this stuff has already happened. He talks about pictures and paintings rather and carvings and books written about stuff, and maybe some people say that this stuff has already happened. So maybe I have already experienced these things that I want to experience or think I want to experience, but instead, and in this lifetime or in this dimension, I'm thinking I haven't experienced yet. So I'm going through the process of, oh, I hope or whatever. So I'm going to wrap this up here by saying it is a bit confusing, especially when we don't look at it and especially when we don't talk about it and especially when we're closed to some of these concepts we need to start considering that there's something obviously bigger going on, that there's more to this than meets the eye, and the stuff that meets our eye, we need to start looking at it. Mm-hmm. The stuff that meets our conscious, we need to start thinking about it, because something is happening when we think that. Something is happening when we see something. We can't just ignore it. And I'll give you one quick last example is I studied art. I took art history, and in the books I had, I had to go and look just to make sure that the pictures and paintings and all that Lamont talks about in his book, Out of Place in Time and Space, I had to make sure that I had looked at them before and not just looked at them, had a teacher walk me through the process. And let me tell you, I don't remember ever having talked about UFOs or aliens or helicopters or spaceships or anything in those paintings, which are in my books. And mm-hmm. So did we not see them? Did we see them and ignore them because they weren't in our consciousness? What? I don't know, but I am so glad we are having this conversation, because this confusion in my mind has to stop. And if I need to start saying I am a ballerina, that's a bad example, but I think you know where I'm going with that. Or I do see that spaceship in that painting that was done centuries ago. What does that mean? I need to start being conscious of all that. I do. At least that's what I feel. And I hope that we all start feeling that, because I don't think it's better to just hide from it. I think the ignorance is not bliss anymore. And with that, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk with Lamont Wood right after this.
Clean water is not enough. Reverse osmosis, distilled water, and most bottled waters are devoid of naturally occurring minerals. They are acidic, unstructured, and hard to absorb, and rob minerals from the body. IonWays ionizers produce a super abundant supply of powerful antioxidants in each glass. Ionized water has a reduced molecular cluster size and a negative charge, hydrating you up to 6 times better. Water from an IonWays ionizer will help you restore your body to its natural pH balance, boosting your vitality. An ionized water more effectively flushes acidic toxins from within your body. Drink the healthiest water available today. IonWays Water Systems, their water changes everything. To learn more about IonWays Water Systems and how you can own one today, visit our website at lifechangeswithfilippo.com and click on our sponsor page. You are listening to Life Changes with Filippo on the BBS Radio Network with your host, Filippo Voltaggio. You can visit us online via Twitter and Facebook, and at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L-I-P-P-O.
We are back. Our guest is titillating our senses in a page-turner of a book called Out of Place in Time and Space, Inventions, Beliefs, and Artistic Anomalies That Were Impossibly Ahead of Their Time. Our guest is Lamont Wood today. He's not only an author of this book, but about six others. He has sold more than 400 bylined articles to Byte, Compute, Information Week, the Chicago Tribune, and the list goes on and on. He's a co-author of Net After Dark, The Underground Guide to the Coolest, the Newest, and the Most Bizarre. He lives in San Antonio, in Texas, and we're happy to have him with us. Thank you, Lamont, for being on the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here. and again, addressing the points you were bringing up in your introduction, my book kind of takes that to the cultural level. Is the future present in the present? Well, I keep finding evidence that it is, or the past certainly is present, but the future sometimes is too. In researching the book, it struck me that we really don't know anything about time. We can't isolate it in the lab. We can't even define it. And throughout the book, I religiously stick to Occam's razor, you know, that the simplest explanation is the best. And applying that to the lack of evidence or with regards to time, I have to lean toward the suspicion that there is no such thing as time. The passage of time is an illusion created by our perceptual mechanism, whatever that is. And when you say all this, are we perceiving stuff in the future? Yeah, it's all happened or it never happened or whatever, you know, that time as we think about it really is an illusion, and we don't understand it because we are stuck inside the gears of the machine. It's like fish knowing what water is. They can't, basically. Anyway, and a good example of, like, say, the future being here in the present, and of course eventually it becomes the past, would be one of the examples I found in the book. The book is about anecdotes that kind of fly in the face of a specifically linear conception of history, because I kept finding things that didn't seem to belong, or people doing things that they should have been doing centuries later, or had knowledge that you wouldn't think they would have at that time. And the freakiest example, the one I can't explain, because some of them I can, would be Jules Verne, someone you've probably heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote about 50 novels during his career, not all of which were science fiction. The science fiction ones did contain quite a few technological predictions, but most of them were extensions of stuff going on in his lifetime and are no great mystery. But in 1865, he sat down and wrote a novel about a U.S. effort to send three men to the moon in an aluminum capsule launched from Florida. They get to the moon, they loop around the moon, they return to Earth, they landed in the Pacific Ocean, and are picked up by the U.S. Navy. Now, does any of that sound familiar?
Indeed.
Right. And he even includes a fairly detailed budget for the project.
Wow.
And I've seen analysis showing that if you include inflation, he was about 85% accurate for the cost of the Apollo program up to Apollo 8, which is, of course, the event he's describing. So, apparently, he didn't allow enough for managerial overhead. A lot of amateurs do that. But where did he get this? You know, how did... let's say there's a bunch of other weird events, similar prophecies that I can pretty much explain away.
Lamont,
this one I cannot.
What about the Titanic one?
Ooh, that is... being a writer, that one is chilling, because it's a guy named W.T. Stead, who was a British journalist in Victorian era. And he was in on the founding of the tabloid genre. Now, recently, after shut down the News of the World, we may be seeing, you know, the end of the genre. But he was there and helped found it in the 1880s. And he had all these causes, and he pursued, and with all the sensationalism and yellow journalism and doing whatever it could to you know, sensationalize things. And one of the causes he set out to sensationalize at one point was the fact that the Admiralty laws did not require passenger liners to carry lifeboats for everyone. And he wrote evocative fiction about what would happen if there was a mid-ocean collision. And the passengers realized there's not enough lifeboats and the panic that would break out and all that other stuff. And the course of his career, he became rich, quite successful. So at one point, he decided to attend a conference in the U.S. And having become rich, of course, he got the best available accommodations for himself. And that was on the Titanic. and you have to wonder what he was thinking after the water was rising. We don't know. He was one of the fatalities. But the irony of it is almost blinding. And that's another theme I encountered when I did the book. I kept encountering tales of people who successfully prophesized things. In fact, built the prophecy into their careers. And it was not always helpful. Now, you would think that would be the surefire route to career success, you know, seeing things in the future successfully. No, it doesn't. With him, and no, it sure didn't with W.T. Speed. Another example.
Well, wait, before you move on, Lamont, I just want to let the listeners know, because they're not in on this, but he actually, he almost predicted exactly the name, or the name was close to Titanic, right? I mean, the boat is situation. Uh-huh. Could you talk about that a little bit?
I don't remember I don't frankly remember he used the name of the boat, but he does describe the setting fairly closely. In terms of the number of passengers, what went on in the course of the disaster. And right. It all matches pretty much what did happen in 1912. Except that he was there. I think you wonder, you know, as he was getting on the Titanic, why didn't he stop and count lifeboats having done all that? But, you know, he had a busy career that he was involved in a lot of things that he probably, you know, maybe it slipped his mind by then. We don't know. But the irony of it is, like I say, there's no escaping that.
He should have had some deja vu or something.
Yeah, it may have been useful at that point. Another example of someone who had correct prophecy and really didn't do him any good would be Hector Bywater in the 20s. I think it was 1925. He wrote a novel about a war in the Pacific between Japan and the U.S. And it begins with a surprise attack, and the Japanese overrun the Western Pacific. And then the Americans manage to launch an island-hopping campaign, which drives the Japanese back to the point where they're able to bomb Japanese cities. And at that point, the Japanese cave in. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Okay. And in fact, he has these fairly blow-by-blow descriptions of some of the battles, and he names ships involved, and some of them do show up in World War II, actual ships with those names. Uh-huh. Now, which seems freaky, but here I remember some of those ships are still around, and two, they recycled some of the names, especially the Japanese. So, and Bywater was what they call a naval journalist. He was a fairly advanced expert in naval matters, and he was trying to show that a war between U.S. and Japan would be painful for both parties. And he had that one right. His book is not totally accurate. I mean, he doesn't place it inside a world war. It's just between the U.S. and Japan. Those final air raids in the Japanese cities, they just drop propaganda leaflets, and that's enough to cause a political crisis and the war. Things like that. But there are things like it takes two attempts to take Guam by the Japanese. In reality, it took two attempts to take Wake Island nearby. Little things like that just leap out at you. There's a big battle near Iwo Jima, not on that island, but a nearby one. There's a big battle in the Palau chain, not on Peleliu, but on a nearby island. You see, in his book, he has the battles for islands with harbors rather than with airfields, because that wasn't an issue in the 20s, but in the 40s, of course, things have changed a little. He doesn't foresee things like radar or atomic weapons. But you have to wonder what else he foresaw, because he ended up drinking himself to death at the start of World War II. Maybe he saw too much. Maybe he didn't want to, you know, go through this again.
And doesn't that raise the question? I mean, you're using the words foresee, or the word foresee. Did he foresee? Did he predict? Was he there and then just came back and reported it? In essence, you're talking about there's no time. We don't understand time. You know what I mean? I mean, or did he write it down and then because it was written so it is written, so it is done, somehow that manifested because it was written and a lot of people read it and it got into the consciousness. Do you know what I mean?
Well, a little of both. Yes, a lot of people read it, including a guy named Yamamoto, who may remember. He was the head of the Japanese Navy at Pearl Harbor.
At Pearl Harbor, and, right.
Yeah, and he absolutely had read it. He, in fact, had made a point of meeting Bywater, and was known to have lectured on the book and various Japanese military academies. And you have to wonder what he began to think as things began to slow down after the first success and seemed to be leading toward the rest of the book when Japan got defeated. But then he was killed in action, and so we don't know what his reactions were. We do know a lot of American military people did read it, and they skipped stage of the book where the Americans try an immediate counterattack to defeat the Japanese in open battle, and that doesn't work. In reality, they didn't even try that. They went straight to the island hopping.
Well, maybe because they
read the book. Yeah.
Work. Yeah.
yeah, they read the book. But beyond that, you have to see it as sort of a metaphorical description rather than an exact description, as you have to do, for instance, Jules Verne's novel. In the World War II thing, he assumes that the opening surprise attack will be an attack on the Panama Canal rather than Pearl Harbor, which would have made sense, actually, but maybe that's why they didn't do it. You know, it's in the book. And Jules Verne, he assumes that the Americans use a cannon and shoot men out of a cannon, which, of course, wouldn't work, but rocket technology in 1865 wasn't such that it would be believable. So you stuck with something believable. Let's say if you kind of stand back and accept it as sort of a metaphor, it becomes eerily accurate. If you try to do a column by column thing, you can see he did miss quite a few things. They both did. There's enough there to really get your attention and wonder what is going on.
Yeah, that's not the only thing I'm wondering. I'm wondering, we need to be careful what we read, what we think, what we write down. It's fascinating me. And actually, there are some other things that I want to talk about that I mentioned in the monologue about, like the flying saucers and the paintings.
Oh, yeah.
And so we'll do that as soon as we come back. We are talking to Lamont Wood, who wrote the book Out of Place in Time and Space. If you want to learn more about Lamont, you can go to www.lifechangeswithfilippo, and we will give his website out as soon as we come back, so you can get the book as well and just be just as riveted as we've been. Lamont, we'll be right back with him right after this.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening, someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within. Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
You are listening to Life Changes with Filippo on the BBS Radio Network with our host, Filippo Voltaggio. You can hear tonight's show and all our past shows, which include luminaries such as David Wilcock, Mariel Hemingway, Giorgio Tsoukalos, Marcy Shymoff, and Shadow Stevens on our archive page at our website at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L-I-P-P-O.com. Remember, you can also connect with us via Twitter and Facebook, and now in our own community at lifechangesnetwork.com, where real people come together to share real life in real time. That's lifechangesnetwork.com.
I am Filippo Voltaggio, and our guest today is Lamont Wood, who wrote the book Out of Place in Time and Space. Actually, he's written a lot of books and a lot of articles and papers, but this in particular has just really captivated my imagination. If this conversation has captivated yours, you can go and get the book at Amazon, amazon.com. And the book title again is Out of Place in Time and Space. You can also, of course, always go to lifechangeswithfilippo.com and click on the link there for Lamont Wood, and it'll take you right to where you can purchase the book. Lamont, before we took a break, we talked about, or I mentioned, that I wanted to know more about these UFOs that were in paintings that I almost could have sworn that they weren't there when I saw them the first, second, or third time even.
Well, and there's a story behind that. And let me explain. Basically, we have our visual vocabulary, and they had theirs. And you were probably got some classical education and the visual vocabulary, and then it was sort of theirs. And nowadays, we have this pop culture visual vocabulary, of which discs in the sky have a specific meaning. And that was not shared by people doing church paintings in the medieval and Renaissance periods. And that is the short and long answer. Now, I have some examples in the book of church paintings in those periods that appear to have flying saucers up there in the air.
Right.
And some look quite convincing. But, again, you have to remember that they had their own visual vocabulary. And round things in the sky usually had something to do with the divine presence. And you can't assume that they're trying to slip in depictions of UFOs because they were always up overhead when they looked up or something. Everything in these pictures is there on the basis of some decision, especially the guy paying the artist. And the guy paying the artist was some kind of churchman, correct? And so the artist needed to deliver what his commission said. So if you have, you know, a picture of the Virgin Mary and Jesus at the Nativity, and in the background, there's something in the sky, and you see in the background, people reacting to it, and they have sheep around them. Well, you're pretty sure that this has something to do with the nativity story in
right.
the Bible, which mentions that there are shepherds in the, with their flocks in the fields, and they're confronted with the heavenly host, and they're amazed, and the angels tell them that, that Jesus is being born nearby. That is what the hips look in here, not a depiction of some visit by extraterrestrials. I'm pretty sure, as a result of my research I did for this book, that if the church had wanted to depict extraterrestrials, they would have done so, and there would be no ambiguity. We'd know all about it. And why wouldn't they? I mean, they dealt with devils and angels and heretics and Turks and whatever, you know, all this other stuff. And E.T. would just have been another, you know, thing on the list.
Right,
but there are quite a few examples, and in fact, there's tons of this stuff out there because, like I say, they had their own visual vocabulary, and they put things in the sky quite a bit, all the time, apparently. And it goes beyond that. I mean, like one of these paintings I talk about, where the one by Crivelli, I think, where it looks like there's some kind of disc thing in the sky, and it appears to be shooting down a laser beam at the Virgin Mary.
Right.
Well, when you get the high-res version, that's a vortex of angels. It's rather obvious. It's not a physical object. And, of course, the so-called laser beam, if you look at it, beside it, there's a dove, and that is straight out of the Bible, the spirit of God descending like a dove on the person. But it goes beyond that. I mean, it's filled with imagery that is completely lost on us on the ground. For instance, in the foreground, there's an apple and a cucumber. I'm sure that's there for a reason. I have no idea what it is. This is a painting about the Annunciation, when the archangel comes to the Virgin Mary and tells her she will give birth to the Christ. And so the archangel is there, and leaning over the shoulder of the archangel is the saint who is the patron saint of that particular city. And the archangel seems like a little annoyed, and it's like waving to get out of the way or something. And you wonder, well, how did they have the nerve to put that in there? You know, municipal boosterism.
Well, there's a peacock right on top of the Virgin Mary on the building, right. Perched on the building, yeah.
What's that mean?
So, as if it could poop on her. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
I mean, I don't mean to be crass. I mean, I'm literally looking at this painting as if, you know, I've never seen it before. Or bars on the window mm-hmm. that look like bars that we would use today. I don't know why they would have
them
back.
Burglar bars.
Yeah. What's that?
Well, it's burglar bars. And I assure you they had that in Renaissance Italy. And for the same reason we have them today.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking at this as if I've never seen it before. But, you know, that one, okay, so that one you can explain away or at least say that disc in the sky is angels. But there's uh-huh. another one that I'm looking at that's also another medieval painting, 1428 here, where these are literally discs, and it looks like there are 15 of them, 20 of them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and little rows and columns, because that is a stiffly done depiction of a snow cloud. And it's about a miracle that took place in Rome in the 300s or something, where in the middle of a hot day in August, snow fell into an outline of a church in response to all these people having the same dream, saying that they're supposed to respond to this miracle and build a church there. This is our miracle of Our Lady of the Snows, I think. And you still see it celebrated in various places. The thing about it is there was no mention of this miracle or the story itself did not emerge until about 1,000 years after the church was built. So obviously it was invented later. But and this is an early depiction of the legend. You can find plenty of other depictions of it, usually a lot more realistic, a lot more relaxed. But this is an early, naive, stiff version to do that by
okay.
someone who didn't want to fill up the whole sky for realistic snow cloud because he had put God and Jesus and the Virgin Mary or something above the cloud.
Okay, so
that's like a disc.
That's an interesting interpretation. Okay, so that's not saying that the sky is full of aliens, but how does one explain away? There's the crucifixion of Jesus. It looks like a fresco.
Oh yeah, the one from Kosovo. Yeah,
1350.
That was drawn 1350. Absolutely, because that is following Byzantine traditions concerning depictions of the crucifixion. And on one side of the cross, you have a celestial object that is red and has a male face, and the other side you have one that is silver and has a female face.
Right. It looks like they're driving, like they're driving a craft or something, or a ball in the sky.
Right. Right. It looks like primitive, naive attempts to depict Mercury space capsules.
Right.
Right. And people started noticing this in the 60s when the Mercury program was in the news. You follow what I'm getting at here? But going back to my original thing, you can find dozens of Byzantine depictions of the crucifixion that follow the same theme. You have the red male celestial object and the silver female celestial object. The red one is the sun. The female one is the moon. The red one is moving toward the cross. The female one is moving away from the cross. And this is in keeping with the depiction, the description of the day of the crucifixion in the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, who say it was dark that day from noon to 3 p.m. So you have to have some code up there showing that the light conditions were changing.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. So in
like I say, they had their own visual vocabulary, and it was quite rich and extensive, and has nothing to do with our visual vocabulary.
Right. So this... Now, it seems like we're saying something different than what we were saying towards the beginning of the show when we were saying that if there's no time, then these people might have been seeing spacecraft of some sort. And I'm not necessarily saying alien spacecraft because mm-hmm. we have spacecrafts now, airplanes and whatnot. So mm-hmm. were they seeing something in the future? Did they actually exist back then?
Well, let me see. In this particular church or monastery with his fresco is painted on the inside of the panel of one of the domes, there are plenty of outdoor scenes. None of them show anything in the sky except this one. And this one, the objects in the sky, like say, follow Byzantine traditions for depicting the crucifixion scene. So I think that's all it is. Now, beyond that, there's plenty of other stuff out there we can argue about. Yes, it's time, space-time continuum is a little porous around the edges. Stuff would probably leak through. And there is stuff that gets your attention. But these particular examples, like say, of UFOs, they can all be explained away, is what I'm trying to get at, if you stick to Occam's razor.
Yeah, that is interesting to have that explanation. Because there's obviously some philosophical questions that all these examples raise. Summing it up, because your book is not just a collection of stories. It's mm-hmm. saying, something is either out of place or out of time and space. So what? How would you sum this experience up in your words of this collection of stories?
Well, that we don't understand time. That's what keeps leaping out at me. And it deserves more attention than it gets. I think we have to come to terms with the fact that we don't understand it, that we may not be equipped to understand it totally. But we need to at least kind of feel around the edges of our ignorance and figure out what we can understand and what we can't. And I think that would point us in the direction of what's actually going on in terms of time. Is it something real, or is it something we just agree to perceive because our thought processes are based on a serial perception mechanism? We have to do one thing at a time. If so, how do multiple people synchronize that? How do we? And maybe we don't and always succeed in doing that. And that's how we get events and stories like the ones that show up in the book. Maybe things occasionally get out of sync, maybe for a whole culture, or maybe just for individuals. I really think we have not scratched the surface in terms of what's going on with time. Now that mankind is better organized technologically, it may be easier to come up with stories like the one ones I've found here that would be better documented now with everything being databases and stuff. I look forward to that happening. But again, that's based on the assumption of time, right? Something in the future.
Right.
I'm maybe going in circles here.
Hey, Lamont, this is Mark Legere. I wanted to chime in real quick and mention something.
Okay.
In listening to you speak and having a bit of a science background, wouldn't it, or am I correct in asserting my feelings here that this is more the dance between the serial ordering, the serial perception mechanism, and the multidimensionality? In our abilities to reach up there in the dream state and achieve, across that timeline, future and past, as well as being able to do that in a lucid, awake state. So we're in essence blending our abilities, depending on what frequencies we're tuning into, to grab information or recognize perceptions in real time as opposed to serial time. Is that making sense? That's kind of how I'm seeing things from what you're saying.
Well, apparently it does happen. Apparently we do pick up information from outside the sequential here and now that we're focused on to follow, through logically about what I was talking about, assuming that, time doesn't exist and it's a product of our perceptual framework. But this information that bleeds through, what use is it? I mean, we can't really do anything with it. We have no basis for analyzing it. And as I talk about some of the things in here, apparently there have been things that show up that basically we didn't understand at the time it showed up. And you might say it was an artifact from the future or something. We simply had no basis for understanding it until later kind of came into synchronization with the here and now. The one I lead off with is kind of an evocative example would be that painting that's been hanging in a museum in France for centuries now. It was painted in 1460. And it's fairly conventional religious painting of the Christ child sitting in the lap of the Virgin Mary. And we, for centuries, we paid no particular attention to what the Christ child was doing. Only in the last few decades did anyone like look at it with eyes that are attuned to the present and realize that the Christ child is depicted as playing with a pull-string toy helicopter.
Right.
Which is kind of strange for 1460. Apparently, those were not uncommon children's toys then. Another theme I came across is that apparently children's toys are considered frivolous. No one pays any serious attention to them. And yet here's a flying machine that kids are playing with. And nothing was done with it for hundreds of years. I also came across the fact that the Greeks and Romans had steam-powered toys, and they never thought to do anything serious with them. But anyway, that's a digression. But yes, absolutely, there are things out there that we simply can't process, apparently, or see them for what they are, because they are not part of our present. You follow me. Am I making sense, please?
Well, I believe you are. But it all makes sense, and none of it makes sense, which is kind of how this all started with the monologue. But I am so glad that you have actually written a book that starts saying, well, let's look at this, because it's here. And it might serve if we give it a little bit more attention. And you have helped focus us in that direction. So, Lamont, thank you so much for having written the book and for having shared it with us today on the air.
Okay. Glad to serve.
Look forward to connecting again when you can help us figure out even more things. But in the meantime, it's Out of Place in Time and Space. Is the title of the book, and you can find it on Amazon and, of course, by going to lifechangeswithfilippo.com. And our guest today has been Lamont Wood. Thank you, Lamont.
Well, thank you.
All right, cha-cha. We'll be back with our producer's wrap and our producer, Mark Leisure, right after this.
Life Changes with Filippo is a premier radio show presented by Life Changes Network, which is a company whose team has dedicated their lives not only to positive change, but to helping others observe and embrace, honor, and even celebrate their own changes, thus enabling a more positive, inspired life and helping to create a more positive and inspired world. From everyday people to corporate giants, celebrities, and children, we are here to help and to serve. With heart and experience, we bring our message and positive intent into your home or corporate office, and even through appearances on your favorite shows. If you wish to learn more about Life Changes Life Coaching and a private consultation with one of us, corporate event appearances, or if you would like us to appear on your radio or TV shows, visit lifechangeswithfilippo.com and click on our representation page. You are listening to Life Changes with Filippo on the BBS Radio Network with your host, Filippo Voltaggio. You can visit us online via Twitter and Facebook and at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L-I-P-P-O.
We're back. I'm Filippo Voltaggio, and we have Mark Leisure with us. Or do we? Did we lose Mark? Mark?
Well, Mark's having technical difficulties, but here we are.
Well, you were in another time.
I was actually out there exploring the multidimensionality of time and information.
We need you here right now, though, but you can. I hate to keep you from that. I know how much fun that can be. We've been talking to Lamont Wood and talking about his book, Out of Place in Time and Space. And, Mark, you haven't seen this, I don't know, maybe you have, but there's a movie, what's it called? But it stars two really funny Italian men, one of them who is Roberto Benigni, and it's in Italian. But anyway, they're two friends who end up in a different time. They don't know how this happened. They were just waiting for the train to pass one day, and then all of a sudden, after the train passed, when they crossed the tracks, they were in a completely different time, a couple centuries beforehand. And at first, they were really confused and didn't know what was happening, and then they started laughing about it, and then they thought they would just fuck with the people and tell them like what's to come. And people would be like, no, no, no way. And one of the best parts is they meet Leonardo da Vinci and they start telling him, hey, have you ever thought of making a helicopter or something like that? And then he starts to design it. And then they go to, who else did they go up to? I don't know, but they're telling people what they should do as if they're really smart. Oh, one of them tells a young lady that he's wooing. He sings her a song, and it's a Beatles song. And she's like, wow, that's a really good song. He says, yeah, it's going to be a big hit someday.
No, that's brilliant.
So I could just see that in reading this book. It's like, what if, you know, and what if we're those people?
There's a movie that had a similar thread recently, and I'm not placing it. But I think that is the interesting thing is, you know, we often say, or you often hear people say, you know, art imitating life, life imitating art. And like most of the things most people do, we just kind of leave it there. You know, just like the old coincidence when somebody calls right after you were thinking of them and they live 3,000 miles away. We just leave it there rather than delving into the ramifications, the odds of that happening, the why, you know, that's enabling all that, you know, these kind of things, that type of integration of information, where the inspiration is coming from, where the collective conscious, if we have now agreed that thoughts are things and we manifest our own reality, and then on the greater scale, the collective manifests the collective reality, then you also have to look at the collective subconscious and all of the images that are out there and what people have seen, when they have seen it. Then you go layers deeper and you start looking at that dream state and the parallel realities and where are we drawing information, visuals, you know, from future, past, other, you know, parallel worlds, etc. It's in, you know, to infinitum in terms of information and input.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you said that because it reminded me of something that happened, what, 3 or 4 days ago that I wrote somebody's name down that I wanted to connect with when I got back from New York. And 15 minutes later, he called me. Now, this is somebody that I hadn't spoken to in a couple months. Also, on that same morning, I also sent an email to you and Dorothy saying, hey, what do you think about having this guy as a guest on our show? And that guy contacted me that same morning after I sent out that email, and you actually had said, yes, get him. He wrote me saying, I'd like to be a guest on your show. And
the signs are all around.
which makes me think, be careful what I write, what I read, what I think, you know, either be careful or it's already happened and I'm thinking it now. So, you know,
or have fun with you, write with what you write, what you think and what you're looking for. I think here's the fun part. We are starting to see this, and those that are aware, that are paying attention to their life, that are able to put themselves in a third party position and kind of watch what's going on around them. The process of manifestation is happening more quickly. So we have the ability to see direct results like that. Mm. I had an instance at the bank that I had to take note of. I have a check that I get from a certain client that always comes a regular way, paper check, and I usually go to the bank to get them to put it in. It's into an LLC, so it takes time to clear. And so the bank will oftentimes release the hold. Well, I went into a branch that wasn't mine, and the guy was clearly having a bad day, the manager. And we got into a discussion, and I said, go in, you know, explain the whole thing. And the discussion started going off track very quickly because he started advising me as to how I should do my banking, rather than just doing what the other branches did and release the hold and check and everybody's happy. And he asked me to step away from the counter so he could go, you know, put the held check in the account. And I had a moment where I could have reacted with anger and frustration and whatever kind of reaction, you know, would have gotten his goat. And I said, you know what? Nope. He's clearly having a bad day. I'm just going to put some love out there. Everything's fine. I don't really need the hold release, so it doesn't matter whether he chooses to or not to, et cetera, et cetera. And he comes back and he goes, I deposited the check and I released the whole thing. Have a nice day. And it was a complete about face with no other catalyst, no possible catalyst for an about face in his energy and the result than my internal change of energy and what I put out there, you know, at a quantum level, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and actually speaking of your beliefs, I remember one time I was saying something, I was a little flustered with a certain situation and I couldn't figure it out. And you just looked at me and smiled and said, you know, on some dimension, we have this all figured out. And I don't know. Did you know how you were saying that? Because there are a lot of different ways one can take that.
I think so.
Yeah, because
I think I knew how I was saying it. How do you think I was saying it?
Well, no, I've just come up with the two ways. The way I thought on the day that you said that is, it's like, you know, on another dimension, it's all figured out, but here it's not. So it's kind of like, oh well, so it is. But now I was thinking the way you kind of said that is, in another dimension, it's all figured out. So it should be clear to now to us if we just connect with that.
Time is and therefore a consciousness is expanding, and so perception and result are happening more quickly and more readily. So one thing may be figured out on another level, but we still have to be able to play by the rules and alter our way of thinking and being in order to affect the change that we're looking to affect that's already figured out on the other level.
I like that. Actually, I like that a lot. And I like your bank story. And it reminds me of similar stories. And I recently had one, actually, the trip I'm going to take in a couple hours here, where someone didn't book my ticket in time who was supposed to, who was going to, you know, I'm performing someplace. So they're paying for the ticket and everything. And they didn't do it in time. So now I'm not able to get the direct flight, and I'm not able to leave at the time that I wanted. And so they're offering me these suggestions, which are not what I wanted. And I started to get upset. Like, why didn't they just do what they were supposed to do? And now I wouldn't have had to be inconvenienced as much as I am. And then I started to remember some of these conversations that I have with you and Dorothy and other friends and colleagues. And I said, okay, if I'm writing this script, then I know that this is perfect. And this is actually better than what I had thought it should have been. And of course, I didn't believe that right away, but I started to convince myself that that was the case. And then come to find out that we find a better flight at a better time with more leg room and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And there it is, when it wasn't there before. Well, maybe it was there before, but we couldn't see it because we were on this track.
Well, and this is, I think, the where it gets fun. We have a team of writers.
Splain. Right? I like it. Splain.
We have a team of writers. There obviously is the primary, the project manager, if you will, our higher self, but each one of our multidimensional selves in each parallel reality is contributing to that whole and to the energy and experience that we are looking to achieve. So that information is incoming from multiple sources and will affect. If you've learned something in one level, you probably don't need to relearn it at another level, and therefore you may aim for a different experience. And so there's so much more going on in terms of the dance that we're dancing. This is maybe we'll do a show on this at some point.
Maybe we'll call it Life Changes. Because it does.
It does indeed.
So here we come to the end, or it could be the beginning, or we might be in the middle of an episode of Life Changes with Filippo. Since we've been out of place in time and space with Lamont Wood and with Mark Lejeur, who knows where we are, but it's good to be here or have been here or we'll just leave it at that. With that, I started this show confusing myself.
Yes, your serial perception mechanism is faltering at the moment, but I think our listeners are with us, so all good.
All right. Well, with that, I, Filippo Voltaggio, along with our producer Mark LeJour and Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our engineer Don Newson, thank you for being part of our world, part of this show, and part of the changes, positive changes, we all wish to see in the world. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to Life Changes with Filippo, with the master of change, Filippo Voltaggio. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the BBS Radio Network and visit us online at lifechangeswithfilippo.com. That's Filippo, F-I-L-I-P-P-O. Today's show has been made possible in part by our sponsors, IonWays Water Systems, Change Your Water, Change Your Life, and Love and Miracles with Dorothy Lee Donahue. To learn more about them, visit the sponsor page of our website. Once again, join us here next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. Now's the time.